Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm Karen Held. I am the Vice President of Stonehill Winery. I'm married to John Held. He is the oldest son of Jim and Betty, who started Stonehill Winery back in 1965.
And there's a prior incarnation of where we're at, right, that goes way back.
Absolutely. We are very historic and started in 1847. We were the second largest winery in the United States at that time and had wines that went all over the world.
And the label at that time was?
It was Stonehill Winery. There were a few reincarnations. Michael Paschal was the original winemaker and owner of the winery, and there was a Michael Paschal brand, but it became Stonehill Winery very quickly.
Isn't that amazing? You're out in the middle of nowhere. They called this the Western Frontier.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet, how did they market and distribute and physically move the product? Amazing.
The United States was a little smaller then, so we were really kind of where it was at. The river was king, and there were railroads taking our products everywhere.
It's just amazing that you could survive and thrive back then.
Yeah, but we didn't just survive, we were thriving.
Yeah, but there was a deal breaker in Prohibition.
Yeah, sadly, it was a time where the community came to a grinding halt. There were vineyards from top of the hill to the bottoms and everywhere in between.
This was kind of the premier grape producing area in America, wasn't it?
It was, it was.
And how soon we forget.
And it was a German community back in the day. That's who started this community, and it hit us very hard in Hermann. The vines were ripped up, everything was dumped, all the wines were poured in the streets, and it was many, many years before the winery was reopened.
That German tradition, the immigrants, was there an Alsatian connection and what they brought with them, their grape producing styles?
I mean, all the immigrants that came over, they were all grape growers, pretty much.
What region or regions? Switzerland? Or?
They were all over.
Okay.
They came from Pennsylvania, so I don't know. I guess everybody that wanted to explore out west just got on a wagon or whatever, how did they get there, and just came over here. But I think the majority of the folks were just grape growers in their profession anyway. I'm not sure which area.
Yeah. Okay, so you're the winemaker here.
Yeah.
Introduce yourself, your name.
My name is Sean Turnbull. I'm the winemaker.
And how long have you been here?
17 years.
17 years.
Yeah.
And you grew up in South Africa, right?
Yeah, I grew up there, lived there for 26 years. Got my training in Cape Town. I got my training in winemaking as well. So I work in the Winelands area down there for about 5 years before making the move over here to join Stonehill.
So you came directly from South Africa to come here?
Yeah, I came directly to Stonehill, yeah.
Did they recruit you there?
How yes,
did
they find you? John, the owner, they were looking for an assistant winemaker at the time, at that point, to help Dave Johnson out. And I was looking actually to move overseas. And
something attracted you enough to move here?
Well, the funny thing is I didn't even know Missouri made wine. I mean, it was like, what the heck? And then I looked at the website and got in contact with John, and he told me, you know, the size of the winery as well as their portfolio, basically all the different wine styles. And that was just mind-blowing to me, you know. And you know, back in South Africa, I kind of felt pigeonholed because it's the big six, you know, you only grow six varieties there and everybody makes the same wine. But over here, you've got all these different styles, and for selling that amount of cases in a place that I had never heard that made wine, you know, that was very intriguing to me. So that's kind of what brought me over here. And so I came over in 2005 to gain a little bit more experience. In 2003, I went from South Africa. I did a vintage in Napa Valley. And assistant winemaker at the time, Joe Norman, And I asked him his background. He was in his mid-50s back then, I believe, late 40s, mid-50s. And asked him, so, Joe, you know, what's your background? Where did you work? And he said he made wine in Missouri, but that didn't register because it's right. Like, they don't make wine over there, you know? So anyway, time went by. I came over here, worked with Dave, and then one conversation led to another. And I said, oh, yeah, do you remember? So Dave was talking to John, and do you remember Joe Norman, who was the winemaker before Dave? Mm-hmm. Coincidentally, I worked with all the winemakers since 1965 that worked at Stonehill, if that makes any sense, you know? So
a long legacy.
So I guess it was kind of meant to be, you know? But no, it's definitely the diversity. I mean, that's what I really like. We make a ton of different styles. Anything basically that you can make grapes into is what we do. So, and
talk to us about some of your iconic varietals that are here, like Norton, for example.
That was probably the most iconic. Back in the heyday, you know, in the Stonehill actually made a Norton that was the best wine in the world.
Wow, that's way back.
Yeah, do you remember the
1873?
Yeah, 1873. Wow. It was in Vienna, the World's Fair. It was crowned the best wine in the world. You know, so
from Missouri.
From Stonehill, yeah, actually Stonehill. And
that is so cool.
You know, it's not just that, but the grape growing industry in Missouri actually helped the European grape industry because
that's a great story.
The phylloxera, this was also in the 1800s, phylloxera is a little aphid that destroys the roots of a grapevine. Mm-hmm. The hybrids and the varieties that grow in Missouri is resistant to phylloxera. And C.V. Riley was the entomologist in Missouri at that time. He found out that the grapevines in Missouri is resistant to phylloxera, and he got in contact with the folks out in Europe, and a lot of cuttings actually from Missouri made it over to Europe, and they grafted their vines onto the rootstock, and that saved basically the European grape variety. So there's a lot of real good history actually in Missouri that people are ignorant about or don't know about.
But it sounds like Prohibition was a real deal breaker for the industry.
I think it's everywhere.
Momentum, but more so than California here. It just kind of a race. Like, you didn't know about Missouri wine.
No, but it's true what Karen said about the German. I mean, when the First World War came around, you know, anybody German were frowned upon. Mm-hmm. And because Herman was such a big German community, that really was a kind of a nail in the coffin too. I mean, there's a few towns, I think the town of Pershing was called Potsdam. They quickly changed their name to Pershing.
After the general.
Yeah. Just to kind of be in more favorable, you know, with the rest of the communities around here. So.
And there were a lot of people that spoke German, and they're German newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
In the German language.
Right? I mean, even a lot of the folks still living here, they've got a lot of, you know, German heritage, German last names. I mean, it's a big German community. And I think it's also, you can see with the wine, more that kind of sweeter style. Mm-hmm. You know, that's maybe what you alluded to, maybe Alsatian, if that's where they came from. I have a little different opinion about that, as somebody gave them a recipe to add sugar to their fermentation. Now, what they didn't realize back then is the yeast don't like sugar that much. You know, if the osmotic pressure is too much, the yeast is not going to survive that, so they're just going to quit fermenting, and then you're left with a sweet wine. It was maybe a recipe that had gone wrong, and then everybody was just used to drinking sweet wine.
Interesting.
That's my two cents.
But things have evolved in the taste palate of the Missourians that come for tasting sugar today, right?
I've noticed that the last 5 years or a few years, there's been the palate has been really sweet. There's been like a change to more of the drier style of wines, like our Ozark Hellbender. Concord, which is a sweet wine, has always been the number one seller at the winery. And a few years ago, 3 years or 4 years ago, 2016 was the first vintage Ozark Hellbender, which is a dry red wine. It's a blend of three varieties.
That's what we got right here.
Yeah, that's what you're enjoying right now. It's very quaffable, you know, just everyday drinking red wine. And that actually took over the spot of the Concord, you know. So there's definitely a change in the consumer. They seem to be a little bit more knowledgeable. They're wanting to know more as well. They're more interested in not just what the parents drink, you know, but I think it's definitely the millennials are influencing, you know, what they're buying, what they're tasting, and they're just more curious people. So a lot of our what we make has changed a little bit too, you know, so we're more focused on our varietals and certain styles more. So
I know where I am, the XY gen, they like that pet natural.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do any of that?
We haven't delved into that yet. That's something I'm very interested in doing. It does take a lot of resources to get that, you know, going during harvest time. You know, something new.
Sure.
But we do make the method Champenois, so which
that's
is
that's really
close
fascinating
to that.
Because a lot of people just go for the quick injection system, and I wonder how many people appreciate what goes in the labor and the time for a classic method Champenois.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people are necessarily versed or schooled into actually what goes into a method Champenois. I just think sparkling wine is sparkling wine, you know. But that's actually my favorite part of our wines is the method Champenois, just because it's got so much diversity to it, you know. And like I talked earlier on, a lot of these varieties, they lack a lot of substance to it. You know, with our method Champenois, we can actually build that substance into it by doing a method Champenois, actually.
And for the listeners, just explain the 1, 2, 3 of that process of the riddling and the time.
If you're talking about sparkling wine or champagne, it can be made in a few different ways. The more economical way and easier way to do it is just by impregnating a base wine with carbon dioxide.
So you just inject and you're good to
yeah.
go.
You chill the wine down, you inject it with CO2, and then you got bubbles in there. It's going to be more harsher, the bubbles, you know, it's not going to be as fine. The wine might not be as full on the palate. Mm-hmm. Where method Champenois is actually the more traditional way of making it, where you have a base wine and you add more yeast to that wine, then you bottle it. And then the yeast is actually what's creating the bubbles with secondary fermentation.
What I love, you go to a wedding, a reception, right? And the people come around serving you champagne. So I look at the glass, and if I see the bubbles going up in a straight stream, I go, yeah, I'll have it. And if it's going in Dr. Pepper fashion,
yeah.
then you know it's the brut, you know, that uh-huh. real quick. Anyway.
So, I mean, it's quite involved, I mean, because you have to obviously put it in special glass, I mean, so it doesn't explode. And obviously, when you do your calculations for sugar, because you got to start a re-fermentation of a dry wine, and the yeast consumes sugar to make alcohol, and the most important part here is carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So X amount of sugar produces X amount of carbon dioxide. So if you add too much sugar to it, it can actually explode a bottle. Those bottles are rated to about 8 bar, which would be...
But you've had pretty good history, pretty good luck.
Well, yeah, you got to do your homework a little bit, you know?
Well, Steve, so. You were telling a story earlier about some friend of yours or whatever that blew up like 450 bottles.
Oh, this was in Ohio. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he was kind of the king of Catawba, and they accidentally, Catawba, it has a lot of what they call foxiness. It's the real
methylenthranolate.
Yeah. Accidentally, they secondarily fermented some of their Catawba wine, and it just took some of that foxiness out, and it became a big hit. So that's all he was making was that sparkling Catawba. Uh-huh. But they didn't have the techniques quite down. But I was reading just last night, actually, he had 42,000 bottles of that blow up as it was aging. So,
wow, yeah. That's painful. Yeah. Yeah, never mind.
The cool thing about a champagne bottle, though, is you can hit it with a knife and sabarge it. That's always fun to do at a party. You just got to do it right.
I've seen the failure.
Yeah, oh boy. There was one actually, where was it, that famous restaurant in Napa, that went viral. Uh-huh. What's it called? Newsom actually went there for dinner and got caught.
Oh, the French Laundry.
Yeah, French Laundry. Oh, yeah, so they brought out, I think it was a 15 liter or something. And the dude that was like the manager, he went at it with a sword, but he hacked at it. And I mean, it just exploded. Nobody got hurt, thank goodness. But oh boy, that was a sad day.
That's really cool. Do you ever have winemakers and friends that you met in Napa come and visit you here?
No, I don't have many friends.
But yet, you have to have some.
No, I mean, I think they're very pleasantly surprised. I've met a few folks that come out here, and the only reason they come out here is because they have family in Missouri. That's the sad part, is that they wouldn't make the pilgrimage just to come explore. I mean, and they're missing quite a lot, actually. And
but once they get here,
I mean, yeah, it's like, oh wow, the wine's actually drinkable, which is kind of a kick in the nuts, but or slap in the face. But you know, it's just how you approach it. But You know, it's just people focus on one area and that's all it is, yeah.
But you guys have been winning awards for your wine.
Yeah, because, I mean, we put a lot of effort into it, and I think, you know, what puts us apart is definitely we put a lot of effort in the vineyard. I mean, and wine is made in the vineyard, and we put a lot of effort into the cellar not screwing it up, you know, all the work they put in the vineyard. So, yeah, I mean, end of the day, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, you know, and I try to put that beauty in the eye of the that beholder. So
your husband,
yes,
he's MIA because he's what out in
it's
the field,
harvest
right?
time. Yeah, wow. Sadly he's busy. He's out in the vineyards checking on things, so they know what they're picking tonight.
So you guys have been here a long time and he's still deeply immersed in day-to-day.
Oh, yes, yeah. Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was saying earlier that we are first and foremost farmers. We grow 95% of our grapes, and
you got 100 acres?
How many? We have almost 200 acres.
200 acres, wow.
Yeah.
All estate grown.
Exactly.
But you
exactly.
do once in a while buy a little extra from...
We have...
What brings you to do that?
Well, we have a special relationship with a grower that we were purchasing grapes from back since we started,
forever,
back in the
yeah.
70s. And he, I think, is probably 85 years old.
Oh, wow.
And we said we would buy his grapes mm-hmm. until he can't sell us any grapes.
Do you have any field management control over his crop?
We do. Okay. Actually, my husband's going to be making a trip down there, I think, tomorrow. They work very closely together.
Yeah, I think that in the industry, if you have that for like 3-4 years, you can call that grape estate grown.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've done business with him on a handshake all these years.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So tell us today, what is your flagship? When the people that are here today, what do they come seeking?
I mean, depends on how you define flagship.
But, well, what's your number
you know,
one
so
seller?
We're, number one seller is Ozark Hellbender, you know, and then Norton is probably our flagship, what we're the most proud of. We make 3 different Nortons. Our estate bottled is a combination of 2 sites of vineyard. Then we make the Cross J, which is a single vineyard, as well as our Old Vine Reserve, which is the pre-prohibition vines.
And some of your vines are ancient vines, right?
Yeah, dating back to Civil War.
That's incredible.
So
it's still producing.
Still producing, yeah. You know, it shows that we're serious about the varieties we grow around here. It's not the commercial varieties, but that's why we grow it around here. It's because it can grow here and it can produce premium wine. So, I mean, what's the point in planting vinifera if you gotta replace the trunks or the vines every year and it's making anyway a lesser wine than other parts?
You really have to come here to appreciate the beauty of your location, the architecture, the setting. But do your best, give us a 1-2 minute kind of visual word picture of the location and what is here.
Well, we're sitting here in the Missouri Valley, the Missouri River Valley. In fact, the entire Missouri River Valley was basically populated by Germans. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's got a lot of the original flavor and heritage still here. Just a nice hilly spot to go. It's tons of B&Bs, just a really nice place. We're actually very close to the Katy Trail, which is a big bicycling trail, so we get a lot of folks to come up here from the Katy Trail, and it's just a nice location, nice quaint little town. So.
And right behind us, you have some beautiful old brick building.
1869.
That is crazy. How cool. Well, only because we're getting the flag from the producer behind us. Our time is up. But thank you guys so much for sharing.
Thank you, Tom.
Welcome. Yeah, and once again, your names and then a website.
My name is Sean Turnbull. I'm the winemaker.
Steve Brown. I'm the tour guide.
Karen Held. I'm an owner with my husband, John. And our website is stonehillwinery.com.
Awesome. And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting. We'll see you here.
My name is Chris Armstrong. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for the Hoffman Family Companies, and I oversee the Augusta Project. This morning, we're at beautiful Montel Winery in Augusta, Missouri. We're on the hilltop looking over the Missouri Valley, and we are in America's first wine region.
That's really fascinating. Tell us the reason why.
So Augusta filed for the first AVA in 1978. It was approved in 1980. AVA stands for American Viticultural Area. So before Napa, before Sonoma, mm-hmm. we were recognized by the federal government as the first wine region.
So that's fascinating. So that means back in the early, mid 1800s, they were producing wine and grapes.
Yeah, so the town of Augusta was founded in 1830 by German settlers. The first winery was built at Mount Pleasant Estates in 1859. The original buildings and structures are still there. There are hand-carved cellars that date back 160 years that are still underground. They're available for touring. And the bricks were all baked and made on site as well, that you can see the brick oven.
Yeah, I mean, touring those old buildings and dungeons and whatnot, it is humbling because you can, it's palpable how hard it was, physical labor to dig.
There was a lot of dedication to do it, but it's really amazing. There's a lot of houses that have cellars on the properties, and one of them dates back to 1830, the original one. And they built that one, they filled it up with sand, and then they put the bricks over top, and then they dug the sand out. And the sand is what made the form and held the ceiling up while they put the bricks and the stone, the limestone. But it was all cut out by hand. It's really amazing.
So talk to us today, the Hoffman family and the Renaissance, literal rebirth of Augusta and the surroundings.
So Missouri at one point was the largest wine producer in the U.S. before Prohibition. Prohibition pretty much killed that, and it wasn't until the 60s and the 70s that it kind of was reborn as people were starting to travel, drive. We're just 45 minutes from St. Louis. Fun fact, Disney World was originally supposed to be in St. Louis.
Really?
That's why you have the shooting star in the logo. Wow. Was a representation of the arch. This area has been seen before as, you know, as potential in the Midwest. So the 60s, the 70s, the town kind of picked back up, but things started declining. You know, Napa Valley became more known. Missouri wine had a stigma of being a very sweet wine, but which isn't true, to be honest.
And well, they did make sweet wines.
Yes, there are sweet wines.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the sad part, because I hear that same, even with Wisconsin wines, you know, oh, it's all sweet.
Yeah, but no, we grow Cabernet here. The Norton, which is a state grape of Missouri, is a very good grape. I would say our 2017 Norton Reserve would go up against any Cabernet. Previous to this, I'll admit, I never heard of a Missouri wine either before I was involved in the project. And
so eye-opening for you.
Yeah, too. Very eye-opening. Yeah. I think at one point we'll do a blind tasting and really and see, you know, what people think of it. Yeah. So the area after the 70s, the 80s started declining a little bit. It's a very small town, 293 people, a lot of third, fourth generation families that live here. And the Hoffmans are actually from nearby Washington, which is only 10 minutes away. They met when they were 15. They've just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, and they've returned to the area. They saw the potential in Augusta and needing a little bit of a facelift and wanting to give back to where they grew up. And last year, in January, the very beginning of January of 2021, we announced a $100 million investment into the area.
Say that one more time.
$100 million. It's now $150 million. Wow. So it's grown a little bit from the original. As we got here, we saw more opportunities, and there's a boutique hotel that's being built into an old property that dates back again to the 1800s. Mm. That wasn't necessarily on the radar in the beginning. We are building a five-star hotel. We'll be breaking ground on
five-star?
We'll be a five-star hotel. We're looking at about 53 to 60 rooms. 53 rooms, 7 suites is ideally what it is. We have 100 acres just off of 94 with an entrance off of Church Street that was rezoned agricultural tourism, meaning that there's guidelines on what we can do with the property. We have to plant so many acres of vineyards. It can only be so many stories high. We can't put up a 30-story hotel. So
you wouldn't do that anyway.
No, we wouldn't do that. We're not developers. That's one thing. We don't tear things down. We're not interested in building apartments and everything else. The buildings for the businesses in town that we had purchased, we renovated in the sense of bringing them up to code, reinforcing the floors, but the original brick is still exposed on the inside of the emporium, the tin ceiling, the original floors. We even have the old tab and the cheese box that people in town that owed 5 cents for milk they hadn't paid or something. So it's really a unique project.
That's really cool. I think the bottom line that makes this so viable in potential is your proximity to major urban Missouri.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, so the St. Louis Airport is only 45 minutes away.
Think about Napa, Sonoma, getting from SFO. I mean, that's double, triple that time if you're not in rush hour.
Yep.
So you guys are potentially spoiled.
Yeah. Yes, we are. And in my opinion, we have more to do here because it is such a small area. There's five wineries in the AVA. We have a complimentary trolley system that runs through town to the wineries. We have a river yacht. It's currently in the area. It's a three-story, 105-foot yacht, holds 149 people. We have overnight guest accommodations. So we've renovated an old log cabin that was, again, built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a little farmhouse that overlooks the vineyards. So there's places people can come and spend the night. There's bed and breakfasts. We have horse and carriages that run in the cooler months. There's just so much to do out here in terms of the areas. It's not just coming out to sample the wine, right, but also to experience the town.
To learn more about your world, do you have a go-to website?
Yep, we do. You can go to visitaugustamo.com, and it has all the information about the town there. My name is Chris Armstrong. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for the Hoffman Family Companies, and I oversee the Augusta Project.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing. This is great.
Thank you.
I'm so glad I came here and never would have guessed it.
Exactly. And that's what we want people to come out. And as we say, we're a taste of history in every glass.
Love it. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Missouri. We'll see you here.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.